So this time around, we're doing one on history, archaeology, and the Bible. Okay? So let's try to set the stage here. See, Christianity and arguably Judaism are absolutely unique in all of the world's religions because Christianity is a story. It's a story set in history. It's the story of what God did over time through a people, through a person and a people. There's no other religion like this. It's talking about Islam. Basically, Muhammad just drops into the Arabian Peninsula, says this stuff, and you either believe it or you don't believe it. But there's no story behind it, no actual history behind it, no prophecies. There's no historical background to Buddhism. It's just either you accept Buddha's philosophy or don't. But Christianity is a story about God working on the earth through people to bring salvation to mankind. So on the one hand, that makes Christianity far more believable because it is a story that's based in history. On the other hand, what if that history were not actually true? Then the entire religion would sink, essentially. So just for the sake of thought, what if Abraham was not even an actual person? Which, by the way, a lot of skeptics say. What if Abraham literally was not even an actual person? Well then, because the story of the Bible is the story of Adam and Eve, of course, rebelling against God, losing their place in the garden. And God has a plan to repair that, and he chooses a man of faith through whom to create the nation of Israel, to whom to send the prophets and the kings and the Old Testament scripture and all that. But what if Abraham was not even a real person? Then the Bible story really doesn't even make sense. What if Moses never lived? What if Israel was never even in Egypt? Then the whole setup with the Passover and Jesus died on the eve of the Passover as prophesied, through the going through the Red Sea, and they were baptized into Moses as we're baptized in Christ. All these things would be like, oh, whatever. Okay. By the way, I'm not saying that Abraham didn't live. I'm not saying Moses didn't live. What I'm saying is, what if they didn't? And the thing is, Christianity or Judaism, if you will, are the only religions that have this, both for the positive, because it makes the religion so much more believable, but for the negative, if it happened to not be true. Just to give you an example of how immersed in history the entire Bible story is, just consider Joshua chapter 1 through 3. Just the first three chapters of Joshua mentions 29 different cities. Jericho, Ai, Hazor, and many, many other cities. Now, the thing is, either those 29 cities are actual cities, or they're not actual cities. And if they're not actual cities, that means that, Joshua didn't win the Battle of Jericho, and the whole concept of them coming into the promised land and the whole symbolism of the promised land being symbolic of heaven and being in the wilderness, being symbolic of our disciple life and all that kind of stuff, all that's just sort of made up stuff. Not only are there 29 cities mentioned just in those three chapters alone, there's 10 different people, Joshua, Caleb, Rahab, 10 different actual people. Now, either Joshua was a real person or not, but since Joshua is a foreshadow of Jesus, even having the name Jesus, and he led them through the water of the Jordan, just like Jesus leads us through the water. Either Joshua is a real person or he's not. Okay, but you have to understand the enemies of Christianity and those who do not believe in the Bible have a habit of saying, there's no such person as Joshua. Come on, that's just a story made up. Okay, now if that were true, then my whole basis for believing would be in big trouble. By the way, it's not true. And the people who say that, I'm going to argue, well, we'll just talk about that. And then there are 17 different peoples. The Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Jebusites. Now, either all these ites are actual people or they're not. And if they're not actual people, then what are we talking about here? See what I'm saying? So, again, One of the beautiful and powerful things about Christianity is that it's a story about things which actually happened. God working through people through history to give us the opportunity to be saved. Unless, of course, it's not even true. All right? So we have to talk a little bit then about history. Christianity and history. I'm going to tell you my thesis at the beginning. You know, when you're teaching, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them, and then tell them what you told them. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to follow that pattern. All right. My thesis is the Old Testament is by far, with second place being way behind, the most accurate and reliable record we have of the history of the ancient world, especially of the ancient Near East. Now, the most famous, well-attested historian from that part of the world was this guy named Herodotus. All right, and he was in the 5th century BC, and his nickname is the father of lies. Okay? And it's not that he was a bad historian, he was actually a pretty good historian, and his histories were mixtures of fables and things that weren't true, but also he did actual careful research, he went to the places. The reason they called him the father of lies is because he was so ridiculously biased in favor of Athens and against Sparta. Now think about all ancient histories, the histories of the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Sumerians, the Persians, they never lost a battle. They never lost a battle. Just read their histories. All right? Did the Jews ever lose some battles in the Old Testament? I mean, the Bible story, it's real. The heroes, the Babylonian heroes, the Egyptian heroes are these perfect people who never did anything wrong. And then we have David. We have Moses. We have Abraham. So, the type of history we find in the Bible is radically different from all other ancient histories. And again, I'm going to state my thesis up front, which, remember, this slide was supposed to make you almost a little bit scared, you know, those first, it's almost supposed to make you just a little bit scared. All right? What if? But this is my thesis. And I believe this thesis is proved by the facts. Okay? So to set the stage, we have to imagine what would be the measure of accuracy and reliability as far as the historical accounts in the Bible are concerned. So this is kind of a brief, very, very brief outline of the history of the Near East for whatever, 2,000 years. So the time of the patriarchs, because before Abraham, Genesis is essentially prehistory. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying the things that are there are not things which you can tie to a definite place and a definite time. But beginning with Abraham, absolutely definite place, definite time. All right, so Abraham, 2050 to 1800 BC, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There, the historical setting should be where in the world? Wait. Where? In, not Israel, no. Well, part of it, yeah. How about in Central America?
No.
Sweden?
No.
So, the setting of that period should be Mesopotamia. The culture should be Mesopotamian. And the laws should reflect Mesopotamian culture. Okay? And then we have Moses and Joshua, the Exodus and the conquest. Right? You can see the dates there, roughly. The period of the judges. Now, things that are occurring in the Exodus, Leviticus, they should reflect what culture? Where? Egyptian culture. Alright, so the earlier part of Genesis should reflect the history, culture, background that you'd find in Mesopotamia around, 1800 to 2000 BC. On the other hand, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy should reflect what you can find and discover and learn about the culture and history in Egypt around 1400 BC. Then we have the period of the Judges. United Kingdom, Northern Kingdom, all that sort of stuff, the dates and all that. Now, where in this timeline should you begin to discover actual things that you could dig up and say, aha, that city, that building, that would reflect something you'd see in the Bible. Where in this timeline should we start to see actual archaeological artifacts? Nope. No. Because they were very, very poor. They were living in huts. They had no power. Thank you, David. So basically, from here back, all we can ask is the cultural things we see consistent with what makes sense with Mesopotamia at that time, Egypt at that time? Only with the reign of David is there any reasonable expectation you could find actual buildings and cities and stuff like that. Got it? So smart. Good job. Okay, got it? The judges, they were hiding out. They were just barely hanging on. They certainly weren't building cities. Got it? All right. Here's another way of looking at it. All right, what should be the dominant powers? Okay? In the earlier part, in Genesis, the dominant powers would be, Hittites and the Egyptians, of course. And then you have Assyria from 900 to 606, Babylon, Persia, etc. So those should be sort of the dominant powers that should be reflected in the things we can read about in the Old Testament. Okay. All right, so to summarize, Genesis ought to reflect the culture of ancient Samaria and Babylon in the period more or less 2,800 BC. By the way, check mark. Then Exodus to Deuteronomy ought to show details of facts and culture and things that reflect Egypt from around 1,400 BC. Check mark. Then the first actual archaeological finds that reflect biblical accounts ought to begin with David and his immediate successors. Check mark. Okay, so let's start with the time of Abraham. Abraham was born in Ur. And if you read the Genesis account, it seems that Ur was a large city. And he came from a wealthy background. It just so happens that Ur, we dug it up. This is the famous ziggurat in Ur. In 2000 BC, Ur was the largest city in all of Mesopotamia. From there, Abraham went to Haran. And Haran was on the way, here we go. Never mind. I want to do a map of the Middle East. All right, yeah, here you go. There's the Mediterranean. There's the Nile River. Here's Israel. And here's Mesopotamia over here. And when they came from Mesopotamia, they went this way. Got it? So Ur is down here in southern Mesopotamia. Got it? No, you don't got it. That's because you're sitting over there. I apologize. But the point is this. Haran is right here. And Haran's been discovered. And if you read the Genesis account, Haran seems to be sort of on the frontier, the frontier of Mesopotamia. And sure enough, Haran is a real place. Unlike Ur, which was occupied for literally thousands of years, Haran was abandoned. Haran was abandoned around 1800 BC. All right? So if the skeptics that say, the Bible is just a bunch of fables people made up, and let's say Genesis was this story, around 700 BC, well, that would mean Haran hadn't existed for 1,000 years. And so how in the world would they have known about Haran? But the reason the Bible records the existence of Haran is because it reflects material that happened when Haran was a smaller city on the fringes of Mesopotamia. Okay, now, these are the Ebla tablets. Ebla is a city, sorry about this terrible map, kind of in sort of northeast Syria. Okay, a large city. And they found something like 3,000 tablets with cuneiform writing. And some of the names found in these tablets include Nahor, Tereg, Abram, Sarai, These are names of actual people who actually lived in Mesopotamia around 1800 to 2000 BC when the, around 2000 BC when the Eblah Tablets were written. All right. Now, by the way, this guy, that's not our Abraham. It's just some guy named Abraham. This is not our Sarai. That's just some woman, Mesopotamian woman named Sarai. And this, you know, Nahor and Terah, they're part of that family, of Abraham's family. All right, so to illustrate this, let's say somebody, you had a friend who was, you know, a campus friend, and they were just talking to you, said, yeah, today I was getting with Gertrude and Harold. You'd go, you got with who? Gertrude and Harold?
Gertrude.
All right? Or let's say, so you found a letter in a drawer somewhere, and it was from the late 1800s. And it was addressed to Skylar and Jamal and Brittany. You go, thank you for laughing. Because remember, in order for us to believe the account in Genesis, if it's reliable history, is it has to be material that fits within the context of Mesopotamia, roughly 1800 to 2000 BC. And here's just one example. So you get the example here, right? Good. Here's another one. There's this interesting story. It's in Genesis 31 where Jacob's been there for 21 years, right? And he's got Rachel, he's got Leah, he's got all his livestock, and at night he just takes off, right? And his father-in-law Laban doesn't figure it out. I don't know why, for a couple of days. And so Jacob's got a big head start. Who knows how far he's gone? And so Laban chases him down off over great distances to get Leah back? No. To get Rachel back? No. To get the livestock back? No. To get the teraphim back, the household gods. All right? That's weird. Until you look at documents from Babylon, roughly 1800 BC, which says, in quotes, whoever possesses the household gods, the teraphim, inherits the family property. Oh, okay. So you have a story that, in the context of, you know, Israel in 500 BC, would be nonsense. That doesn't make any sense at all. So what this tells me is Jacob and Laban are actual people who actually lived in that period. Otherwise, you couldn't have made up this story. You literally could not have made up this story other than if you'd lived in Babylon, but in Mesopotamia around 1800 BC. Okay, other examples. In Genesis 14, verse 2, there's this battle between the League of Five Cities in the area around the Dead Sea with Chedorlaomer, I forget where he's from. But anyway, and so these five, you know, the five kings get together, and then they go and fight, what's his name? Chedorlaomer, and they're defeated and all that kind of stuff. But here's the problem. If you go to the Dead Sea today, there's a reason they call it the Dead Sea. I've been to the Dead Sea a couple times, and I'm telling you, it is just about the most desolate place on earth. And not populated. I mean, there's a few Bedouin there, but basically it's so dry. The idea of having a farm there is like, sure. But if you read the Genesis account, Abraham said, you know, you get the good farmland, the green farmland down there by what we call the Dead Sea, and I'll take the sort of not so great farmland up here in the hills in Judea. All right? And so those who tend to criticize the Bible, which is a lot of seemingly smart scholars, said this is obviously not true. There's no Sodom, there's no Gomorrah. But then, about 30, 40 years ago, some archaeologists thought, you know, let's just check around. Maybe there would be some actual remnant of whatever went on. What they discovered is around 2200 BC, between that time frame, around 2000 BC, it's not like it was this lush thing. There were these wadis. These wadis are periodic rivers, but back then they ran all year. And so there was extensive irrigation. Kind of like here, kind of like in the Central Valley. If you didn't have water come from over there, we wouldn't have any farms here. I mean, so the bottom line is there was extensive irrigation, and the really good farmland back then, believe it or not, was by the Dead Sea. And what they discovered is at the head of these wadis, they discovered some ancient cities. Now guess how many cities they discovered?
Five.
Five. All of which were destroyed somewhere around 2000 to 2100 BC by fire. Okay. Now the largest of those cities is Bab ed-Dra, which almost certainly is the biblical Sodom. And there was a graveyard outside the city, about a kilometer outside the city, with these wooden structures. And when they burned from the top to the bottom. Now, generally, when you burn down buildings and stuff, you burn them from the bottom to the top. But interestingly, these grave structures were burned from the top to the bottom. You know what we're talking about, right? Does this prove that fire and brimstone fell on this city? That would be a huge stretch. But what it shows is everything we know about these cities and the archaeology here is absolutely consistent with the Bible story, contrary to what other people would have said other than the Bible. Okay, here are the ruins of Bab ed-Dra. All right, how about the Hittites? Hittites mentioned 40 times, 7 times in the Old Testament. And it again, when you're reading during Exodus through Deuteronomy and even into the Judges, and even later, even to the time of David, it seems like the Egyptians and the Hittites are the sort of the people talked about the most. And yet, up until the early 20th century, the dominant accepted truth was the Hittites were not real. Neither were the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Girgashites. Basically all just, you know, a bunch of stories that these Jewish rabbis made up to make their children obey their parents or something like that. And so it was assumed that the Hittites were just invented. Then in 1907, Hugo Winkler discovered the city of Hattusha, which is a large city. Here is the gate to the city, the Lion Gate to the city of Hattusha. It turns out the Hittite Empire controlled almost central and eastern Turkey and down into the Levant. In fact, it was the chief rival to the Egyptians from around 1900 BC to around 1400 BC, which fits the context of the Old Testament very well. So you know what? I believe that the Hittites were real. I believe the Canaanites were real. And the Hivites and the Perizzites and all those otherites. Now, I admit I can't give you hard and fast proof that the Girgashites, you know, I can't. But you know what? Here's the thing. These critics of the Bible, they say, that's not true. That's a fable. That's a fable. You say, well, no, actually that's true. Actually, that's true. True. That's true too. Okay. Well, that's true. But this is a fable. And this is a fable. And this is a fable. At some point, you kind of go, benefit of the doubt goes towards the Bible. And again, there's no other ancient history even remotely in the same league as the Old Testament. You can actually get a major. There are a couple of universities you can actually get a major in Hittite studies. So scholars now believe in Hittites. All right, here's another one. Now we're moving towards the Exodus. This is the papyrus Ipuwer, found in Egypt, reflecting events somewhere around 1400 BC. And in the papyrus Ipuwer, there's an account that says the river is blood, or the river was turned to blood, Exodus 7:20. And another thing in papyrus Ipuwer, blood is everywhere throughout the land, trees are destroyed, hail broke every tree in the field, Exodus 9:25. The land is not light in papyrus Ipuwer. You have Exodus 22 about 10:22 about the darkness. And then in Papyrus Ebor, whatever, 213, he who places his brother in the ground is everywhere. And of course you have Exodus 12:30, for there was not a house where there was not someone dead. Is this proof of the 10 plagues? I wouldn't go that far. It's suggestive. All right, here's another one. These are Tel El Amarna letters, again in a cuneiform type script. They're called the Tel El Amarna letters because they were found in Tel El Amarna, which is in Egypt, a city that was built in around 1400 BC. Okay? And they found letters, a bunch of letters written to Pharaoh, and these letters came from little minor kings living in what we call Palestine. All right? And they were just sort of business letters, but one of them had the following inscription. This is from around 1400 BC, folks. All right, got it? The Hapiru plunder all the lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king, the Lord, will remain. But if archers are not here, then the lands of the king, my Lord, are lost. All right, there you go. Who do you think the Hapiru might be? The Hebrews. Yeah. Okay? So, I'll ask you a question. Did the archers get there within that year? Or was the land conquered? Where might you look up to find the answer to that question?
They were conquered.
Yeah. Go to the book of Joshua. Okay. Okay. Archaeological facts about Jericho. The city was strongly fortified in the late Bronze Age period, around 1400 BC. The city was massively destroyed by fire around 1400 BC. The fortification walls collapsed at the time the city burned. The destruction occurred at harvest time in the spring, as indicated by large quantities of grain that were stored in the granaries. All right, the siege of Jericho was relatively short, again, as evidenced by the large amount of grain stored in the city. Contrary to what was customary, the grain was not plundered. All right, now, we know one guy, what's his name, did a little plundering. You got in big trouble. I forgot his name. Oh, that's so embarrassing. I'm a preacher. I'm supposed to remember his name. The guy who... Not Korah, that's Korah's rebellion. Anyway. You see that? Does that prove that the Israelites under Joshua went around the city and when they blew the horn, the walls collapsed and they went in and conquered that city? It doesn't prove it, but it's certainly consistent. It makes sense. By the way, one of the criticisms of the account in the book of Joshua is that not very many cities were destroyed in Canaan at that time. All right, but if you read the biblical account, they only destroyed three cities. That was Hazor, Ai, and Jericho. The city of Hazor has been found, and it was massively destroyed in around 1400 BC. Of course, Jericho was also destroyed in 1400 BC. The location of Ai remains uncertain, so it's hard to say about that. Okay, got it? Achan, thank you. He was aching for a bruise. That's what my mother used to say. You're aching for a bruise. So there you go. Here we go. Here's the stela of Merneptah, 1220 BC. And it mentions, it's right about, trust me, it's right about here. It mentions Israel. So we know that Israel was a peoples living in Canaan in 1230 BC. And I don't have a picture of it, but just very recently in 2014, another inscription was found that mentioned Israel and Canaan in the 14th century, another 1300s BC. Okay? Again, consistent. All right, now we're moving forward. Like I said, the first time you can hope, reasonably expect to find actual physical objects, that reflect things that happen and are recorded in the Old Testament about the Jews would be around the time of David. By the way, people will say there is no actual proof that Israel was in Egypt.
Really?
And yes, and it's because it's true. There is none. Well, what would there be? Did they build temples there?
No.
Did they build large cities there? Well, they built cities for the Egyptians. They were slaves. So what would you find? There'd be nothing to find. In fact, yeah. And also, there will never be any, you know, the whole 40 years in the wilderness. You're not going to find any evidence of that. What would you find? They built a fire or something like that? Or they had some sheep? All right. So don't expect to have these great archaeological discoveries proving Abraham. Abraham slept here. You know what I'm saying? He's living in a tent. So when should you start to see actual physical objects that reflect things in the Bible? The answer is around the time of David or soon thereafter. So we have the Moabite stone, which is in the Louvre. Now, some people go to the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa. I go to the Louvre to see the Moabite stone. That's way more exciting. Okay? It comes from Moab. By the way, what you never find is carvings of, like, the kings of Israel. Why not? Because it says, do not make a graven image. So if you want to find images showing Israelite kings and stuff, you have to go elsewhere, which we'll see. Those exist, but not in Israel. Make sense? Anyway, this Moabite stone mentions Abraham of the house of Omri. In other words, apparently there was a lineage, a dynasty in the northern kingdom begun by Omri, which eventually led to Ahab. So I believe that there was a northern kingdom. I believe King Omri was the first of that dynasty, and Ahab as well, Ahab, Jezebel, etc. Reflecting events in 1 Kings 16. Then we have the Tel Dan inscription. A friend of mine, John Wilson, he was in the city of Dan the day this was discovered. He was there doing archaeological work as part of the people doing it, but he wasn't the one who discovered it. But there was this one lady archaeologist who... By the way, in the ancient Near East, what they'd do is they'd destroy cities and they'd level them and then they'd take the stones and build a new city. So this stone is just sort of a random stone in a wall somewhere from a sort of recycled city. But it's sort of cool because what it says is this. It says, this is the king of Aram boasting. He said, I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. Okay? What that tells me is there was a northern kingdom, and there was a southern kingdom, and who was the first king of Judah, the southern kingdom? David. Yeah. So, yeah, by the way, before this Tel Dan inscription, the majority of opinion was that there was no such person as David. That was the majority opinion. Thank you. That's crazy. Now, we know, of course, there was. And the thing is, after 20 or 30 of these discoveries proving their claims that these things aren't true, wrong, that they're actually true, you think they start to say, maybe we should believe the stuff in the Bible we don't have actually proof for yet. But that's not what happens. But honestly, being fair to the archaeologists, it's sort of their job. It's the job of archaeologists to act this way. But how about the job of Christians, you know what I'm saying, who happen to be archaeologists? Actually, it's not true. At least according to 2 Kings 8:28 through 29, Jehoram was wounded, not killed. He fled the battle, and it was killed by Jehu. Now, let me ask the most obvious question. This question is the easiest question to answer in the world. Which is more likely to be a reliable statement of the facts? That King Hazael, or whatever his name was, killed Jehoram, Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, or that it was Jehu that did, and he was wounded? The answer is, it's obvious. The biblical account is the correct account. It's obvious. Common sense. Because the bottom line is, he was wounded. He thought he killed him. He's not lying. He just was wrong. And we have the more reliable account because the Bible is always more reliable than all other ancient historical accounts. End of story. All right, here's another one. This is Jehu. Now, this inscription was found in Nineveh, not in Israel. It's the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser. I actually took that picture. It's in the British Museum. It's not a very good one, but I'm so proud that I took that picture. You can see there's Jehu right there. By the way, this shows Jehu bowing down to the king of Assyria. And what we have is in the Bible, it says that Jehu paid tribute to Assyria, 2 Kings 17:3 through 6. Now, did Jehu ever actually go to Nineveh and actually bow before the Assyrian king or not? I don't know. I mean, this represents the idea that he submitted, which of course is true. We know that. How do we know that? Because not only did Shalmaneser III mention that Abraham bowed before the Assyrian king, but also 2 Kings 17:3 through 6. Got it? Okay. Now I know that this is not like the most incredibly exciting. To me, this is like so exciting. For you, it's like, okay, you know, but I'm telling you, this is important to supporting our faith. So you should be excited. Okay. Here's another one. The Sennacherib cylinder. So we have these different kings. There's Shalmaneser in the late 9th century BC. They have Sennacherib in the late 7th century, late 8th, early 7th century BC. Sennacherib cylinder, also called the Taylor Prism. It's in the British Museum. It looks like this huge thing, but it's only about this big. The writing is tiny. Yeah. When I came around the corner and the British Museum and I saw that, I was like, oh my goodness, that's the Taylor Prism! Whoa! I know that's nerdy, but what can I say? Anyway, somewhere in there, I don't know where, but somewhere in there, Sennacherib gives the following boast. I seized 46 of his strong cities. That's Hezekiah's strong cities. As to Hezekiah the Jew, I made him like a bird in a cage. So you have the most powerful world ruler in the entire Near East area at the time. He campaigns in Canaan, and he destroys many cities, all of which is recorded in 2 Kings 18, including Lachish. We'll have a couple slides on that next, the destruction that happened at Lachish. In fact, the only city he did not destroy was Jerusalem. And his huge army of something like 160,000 soldiers surrounded Jerusalem. That's when they built the tunnel. I'll show you the Siloam inscription. All right. And so it's interesting. What did he say that he did to Hezekiah? He put him under siege, right? What does he not say he did to Hezekiah? Conquer him. You know why? Because he didn't. So we have indirect evidence of that miracle, the miracle recorded in 2 Kings 18. What happened? The angel came, destroyed the army. That's what happened. Now, I'm not saying this proves beyond any doubt the factual nature of that miraculous event, but I'm saying, oh, that explains it. That really explains it. So there you go. All right. Of course, I say of course. If you know the Bible super well, you know that Hezekiah built that tunnel. And because there was this spring, that Gihon spring, which was quite far outside of the city, and so they built this tunnel. It's like 3/4 mile long. They started inside the city and at the spring, and they met in the middle. And when they discovered that spring around, 2,300 years later, they found this inscription right at the point where the two tunnels met. So you know what? When it says in 2 Kings 20, 20 through 21, now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah, all his might, and how he made a pool and a tunnel and brought water into the city, are they not written in the books of Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? Sure, they are. And there you go. So, by the way, it's not there anymore. I actually walked through that tunnel. It's so awesome. kind of duck a little bit. It's really cool. And there's still water. There's still water in that tunnel. And it goes to the Pool of Siloam. It's the thing that sent water to the Pool of Siloam. All right. And in the inscription is, the boring through has now been completed. So you know what? I think there was an actual person named Hezekiah. I think Sennacherib did indeed put the city under siege. I believe Sennacherib did lose that because his army was destroyed by, not by the Jews, who had no way they could ever defeat Sennacherib, but by the holy angel. Then there's Lachish. Lachish is a city not far from Jerusalem, which has been conquered once and destroyed by the Assyrians, and we'll see later on by the Babylonians. Kind of a sad history. And if you go to 2 Chronicles 32:9, it records how first, basically it records the siege and destruction of Lachish and the horror of it. This is Sennacherib, 701 BC. There's an entire room in the British Museum. An entire room. You can't even see it. I took that picture also. You can't even see it. It's this huge room filled with these bas relief sculptures. These are Jews, clearly Jews, being taken in captivity into Assyria. There's the Assyrian soldiers. There's the Jews. Right? I mean, that's definitely what that is. And these are from Nineveh. These carvings are found in Nineveh. And it's Sennacherib boasting about the destruction of Lachish. All right, here's some more things. They're being flayed alive. They're being skinned alive. The horrors of what they did to the Jews. And it's recorded in the Bible. And here we go. All right, another one. I'm almost done with the Old Testament. The story is already told, but I'm gonna do a few more just because I enjoy this. But Babylonian Chronicles. Now we're going forward another 150, 200 years. Now we're talking about the time not of the Assyrians. Now we're talking about the time of the Babylonians. So here we go. In the seventh year, the month of Kislev, the king of Babylonia, also known as Nebuchadnezzar, mustered his forces and marched to Syria. He camped against the city of Judah. We know it as Jerusalem. And on the second day of the month of Adar, he took the city and captured the king. He appointed a king of his own choice. We know him as Zedekiah. The year is 597 BC, as recorded both in the book of Jeremiah and in the book of 2 Kings and in the book of 2 Chronicles. He appointed a king of his own choice, Zedekiah, there, and took its heavy tribute and brought them to Babylon. So you know what? I think it's true. I think it's actually true that Nebuchadnezzar did indeed take Jerusalem, did indeed deport King Jehoiachin to Babylon, and did indeed leave Zedekiah in his place. Here's one of the Lachish letters. Now these are found in the city of Lachish, right by the gate, massively burned, but under the charred remains they found several of these letters. These letters were recorded in the year 588 BC when Nebuchadnezzar came back for a second time and this time destroyed Lachish, destroyed Azekah, destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple and everything, just wiped them out, fulfilling the prophecy in the Old Testament. And this is in Hebrew script, and the quote, this is matching the events in Jeremiah 34, verse 6 and 7. What it says is, the light at the top of Ezekiel just went out, and we are next. So the person who wrote this probably died within 2 or 3 days. Because the biblical account is, first Nebuchadnezzar took Ezekiel, then he came and he took Lachish, and then he took Jerusalem. Yeah, so I think these events actually happened, and if this is not proof, what could be more proof that this is something that actually happened? Here's another one. If you read 2 Kings 25, 27 through 30, it says that Jehoiachin was taken into captivity, but rather than being killed, he was actually treated like a king. So while Zedekiah is back ruling in Judah and eventually messing up and getting killed and all that, Jehoiachin stayed there for 30 or 40 years under captivity. And what it says in 2 Kings 25, 27 through 30, it says, day by day, the king, that is Nebuchadnezzar, gave Jehoiachin a regular allowance as long as he lived. And they found in Babylon this list of essentially supplies given to different people. One of the names on there is Jehoiachin. And interestingly, he is given 20 times more food than any of the other people on the list, being treated like a king in Babylon, confirming this fantastically minor detail recorded in 2 Kings 25, 27 through 30. And then there's the Cyrus cylinder. This is Cyrus. Now we're going forward another 50 years to the destruction of Babylon, as recorded in Daniel. Daniel chapter 6 records in detail what happened that night. Anyway, here in the Cyrus cylinder, Cyrus boasts, this is the king of Persia, he boasts, I return to the sacred cities, the sanctuaries of which have been in ruins. And of course, one of the city peoples he restored was the Jews. In fact, you can read Ezra chapter 1, verse 2 through 4, which is virtually the same words in a letter that Cyrus gave to the Jews. This he said to all of the peoples, and we have in Ezra a letter, almost a direct quote. All right, so yeah, I think those things really happened. And people will say these are a bunch of stories people made up just because they were hoping that you'd believe this stuff. Okay, this is my favorite though, at least from the Old Testament, my favorite. This is Daniel 5. Daniel 5 is the account of the destruction of Babylon. Okay? And when you read the story, it mentions this king named Belshazzar. Interesting, because Daniel was called Belteshazzar, and this king was called Belshazzar. And so according to the biblical account, the last king of Babylon was Belshazzar. But there's a problem. Because there were many other accounts of the history of the Babylonians, and all of them said, without exception, that Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. Again, there you go. Daniel is just fable. You know, come on, Daniel and the lions, Daniel, yeah, whatever. There's no Daniel and all that stuff. But then they found an inscription in Ur. Oh, by the way, there's an interesting thing, because when Belshazzar asked Daniel to come in and interpret the writing on the wall, he says, anybody who can interpret the writing on the wall, I'm going to give the third highest place in the kingdom. Notice, the third highest place. Okay? Why is that? So number one, why the third highest place in the Bible? And number two, what about this guy, Belshazzar? Then they found an inscription in Ur that explains exactly why. This is found in the 70s. I believe it's the 70s. Don't quote me on there. Somewhere about that time. And what it turns out that Nabonidus was he did a palace coup. He killed evil Merodach and he took the throne, but he had no legitimacy. So what he did was he married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter and he had a son. Guess what his son's name was? Belshazzar. And once Belshazzar reached majority, he made him his regent king. He ruled as a regent. All right. And the reason he did that is because unlike Nabonidus, who had no royal lineage at all, his son was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Smart move. All right? In fact, if you read the accounts, Nabonidus was hardly ever even in Babylon. So for something like 17 years, Belshazzar had been ruling as effective king. But that explains this interesting little tiny detail in the book of Daniel. Because he said, anyone who can interpret the writing written on the wall will receive which place in the kingdom?
Third.
Why the third place? Well, who occupied the second place in the kingdom? Belshazzar. Ah, so again, the Bible is confirmed. At what point are these skeptics and cynics going to admit the obvious fact that the Bible is reliable, accurate history? Now, by the way, I can give you no evidence that David killed Goliath, and almost certainly we never will. Okay? So there are almost an infinite number of facts recorded in the Old Testament that we don't have proof of that. We just have to rely on the Bible. But here's the thing. Every time you can line up anything we know from ancient history with the Bible, it lines up perfectly. So what's the most reasonable conclusion? It's because the Bible is the most reliable ancient account of history in the world by far. And if you don't believe that, just start reading Thucydides and Herodotus and Tacitus and all these other historians, and you'll see the difference. Okay. Now, I've really done enough. We could do stuff with the New Testament, but honestly, the need to verify things in the New Testament historically is less, simply because we have the accounts of the people that lived at that time, all right? And, you know, nevertheless, you know, the people claim for a time that Pilate never ruled as procurator of Judea. And then in Caesarea Maritima, they found this inscription from roughly 30 A.D., which says, Tiberius, who was the king at the time, and then Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea. So I think Pontius Pilate really did serve as prefect of Judea during the reign of Tiberius. All right. By the way, I believed that long before I heard about this inscription, but you know, it's kind of nice to have that. All right. And here's an actual nail that was put through an actual ankle found in Canaan. So that was how they actually crucified at that time, as brutal as it may seem. Here's the Pool of Siloam. It's a real pool. You can go there. All right. You get a sense for what happened there with the man born blind. Here's the Caiaphas ossuary. It's a bone box. And this is the ossuary of the Caiaphas, son of Joseph, who is found in the book of Luke, in the book of Matthew. All right? This is an inscription found in Jerusalem. The word is Corban. 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 Whatever. Maybe it's Corban. I don't know. Whatever the best way to pronounce it is. And Jesus talks about that in Mark 7:11. Oops. Oh, what did I do? Oh, that's right. I did that. Wrong button. All right. Sir William Ramsay discussing Luke as an historian. And basically, Ramsay, he's a late 1800s. He was the penultimate greatest archaeologist of Middle Eastern studies in the second half of the 19th century. He was a skeptic. He was a virtual atheist. And when he started his studies, he assumed probably that the book of Acts was written in the second century, not the first century. And it was an account that had no real connection with any political reality. All right. But basically, in the end, he decided, it's kind of long to read. Basically, I'll just give you here we go. Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he is possessed of the true historic sense. He fixes his mind on the ideas and plan that rules in the evolution of history, proportions the scale of his treatment to the importance of each incident, basically says he is a first-rate historian. All right, here's an inscription found mentioning Sergius Paulus, who was on the island of Cyprus, Acts 13. Here's an inscription found in Thessalonica mentioning the Politarchs. The political title Politarch was found nowhere on any ancient writing anywhere from Roman times. The only person who mentions the word Politarch anywhere is Luke. And he uses it of the leaders of Thessalonica specifically. And sure enough, there's an inscription mentioning Politarchs in Thessalonica. Gallio, an inscription mentioning Gallio, Acts 18, an inscription mentioning Erastus, dating the book of Paul being in Corinth, second missionary journey to 52 A.D. That's you get the Felix, and yes, he really was the guy who was ruled in that time. Okay, summary, because I got to stop talking. We cannot prove the Bible or the claims of Christianity using ancient history and archaeology. All right, I cannot use archaeology to prove that Jesus was raised from the dead. I can use history, but not archaeology. But we can disprove the radical claims of the skeptics that the Bible is largely composed of fabricated stories. That is not true. It is not fabricated stories. All right, to the extent archaeology answers that question, right? In fact, we can conclude that to the extent we can compare history and archaeology to the Bible, it confirms that the Bible is by far the most accurate record of events and Near East in biblical times. This is strong evidence for the inspiration of the Bible, as no other ancient record is as faithful to the reality of history. All right, so we have time for question and answer if anybody has some. Questions, if you have any. Yeah.
What was it like seeing all these different stones? Like, you know, you've seen pictures of it, and you've seen
the
books.
I've seen many of them, actually, in the actual museums.
Like a big, you know, what was like a big, what's different?
I mean, really, I kind of already knew they were there. I'd already seen pictures of it. But it's, for me, I'm just sort of an archaeology geek. For me, it's like, it's inspiring. Yeah. But maybe you just go, okay, that's Cyrus Cylinder, that's nice. For me, it's really exciting. Yeah. Garrick.
How are they able to read it and translate it?
Which thing? There's many different inscriptions. Okay. The Rosetta Stone, which was found in Egypt, is actually also in the British Museum. And that has, it has Greek, basically, hieroglyphic and a third language. And that was used essentially to allow them to, basically all the languages in the Near East that were written at the time have now been translatable. So it depends. I mean, we saw stuff in Hebrew, we saw stuff in hieroglyphic, we saw stuff in cuneiform. Cuneiform language is now readable, hieroglyphic is now readable, they're all readable. The Rosetta Stone was the key to kind of, that was found in right around 1800, Napoleon in his little thing that he went to Egypt. They found the Rosetta Stone, and that was interpreted by about 1815, 1820. From that time, most of the Near East languages were then readable. Yes?
In these museums that you're talking about, is there an inscription?
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Bottom of what, of our translation?
Well, I mean, yeah, right. You're not going to go up to the Taylor Prism and start reading it.
But is there an inscription on the bottom in English and other languages? That's what
they will not give you all the information that I'd give you. They would probably say Taylor Prism. I can't remember what the little thing said. Taylor Prism, you know, found in such and such place, a date, place, that kind of stuff. So you, in order to go, whoa, that's an aha moment, you might have to actually know a little bit of the background of the Taylor Prism or the Cyrus Cylinder. All right. For those who are kind of wonks of such things, I could see the Cyrus Cylinder from across the room and go, oh, that's the Cyrus Cylinder. But most people would know that. I don't remember what the little thing said with the Cyrus Cylinder, but I don't think it said, this thing has a quote very, very similar to Ezra chapter 1 verse 1 and 2. I don't think it says that. Oh, you're stretching. Okay, go ahead.
Do you have proof that other than the apostles, so people just say they were just like made up?
All right, it's not like you can dig up a body and identify that person. There's rare exceptions. For example, some of the mummies that have been found in Egypt, they actually know who the actual person was because it says it right in the sarcophagus. And they've even, believe it or not, you can actually retrieve maybe not nuclear DNA, but mitochondrial DNA. You can actually even show King Seti related to this person, that kind of stuff. But for virtually anybody you could ever dig up anywhere in the ancient world, there'd be no way to even begin to identify that person. But what we can say is there are three New Testament characters whose burial place we know with almost 100% certainty, and that is in the Basilica in Ephesus, that is where John was buried. And we know the place. And then Paul was almost certainly buried in St. Paul's Cathedral in Rome. And Peter, even more likely, Peter is buried in St. Peter's in Rome. So those are three apostles. Essentially, we know where they're buried. But, you know, how would you really prove that? I mean, sure, there's somebody buried in that sarcophagus in St. Peter's Cathedral, but how could you prove that that's actually Peter? There's no conceivable way you could. All right, and besides, you know, although those are probably genuine, there's all these relics, and the Catholic and Orthodox Church had this big, basically a relic industry claiming these are pieces of the cross and this is the jawbone of James and stuff like that. All right, so those three apostles, we know almost certainly essentially when and where they died. Also, we know James, the brother of Jesus. We know he was killed, I think the year 63 or 64 AD. That's recorded by Josephus. And also we know James, the lesser of the apostle James, that he was killed by Herod Agrippa. So those are the confirmed history of apostles that we can say. And then if you read Eusebius, who wrote in the early 4th century, he'll say what happened to Thomas, what happened to Bartholomew, what happened to all these other people. Eusebius was not just making stuff up. So it's somewhat likely that some of the accounts of the other apostles found in Eusebius are what actually happened. But to be honest, the ones I listed are the only ones we know pretty for certain their fate. Yes?
Do you have any where to point if I want to learn more about, like, Bronze Age culture in Mesopotamia?
There's infinite number of books on that. You could probably take a class at UC Merced on ancient Near East history and probably take a class. I've read a lot of books on that sort of history.
Yeah.
Go to the library.
There you go.
Do they have a library here?
Yeah.
Do students actually go to it? People actually take books out and stuff like that and read them? I'm kidding. I've been in the library. Now. Just go to the ancient history section and take a book on Bronze Age history. The Bronze Age starts when bronze was essentially first created, all right, around 1500 BC, and it totally revolutionized warfare, that's for sure. Yeah.
I'm just wondering.
1800 BC. Sorry.
I'm just wondering about the Vatican. Like, do you think that they would have more artifacts or manuscripts about the Bible?
The Vatican has the Codex Vaticanus, which is a complete New Testament and Old Testament in Greek from 350 AD. It's there right in the Vatican Museum. The Vatican Museum has a lot of stuff, lots of ancient manuscripts. It's not the best place to find very, very early manuscripts is actually in Dublin.
Ireland?
Yes. The, what's the name of the museum? Jan and I were at that museum.
St. Patrick's.
No, it's at the Bodleian Museum. No, that's Oxford. Anyway, there's this museum. It's very close to the university there in Dublin. And it's the such and such library. I forget. But anyway, they have dozens of manuscripts from the 2nd and 3rd century. Dozens of papyri.
Is it the Chester Beatty?
Chester Beatty Museum, yes. And the Chester Beatty, that's the largest collection of papyri. The Codex Vaticanus, which is along with Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus, these are three entire codices of the New Testament and the Old Testament in Greek. And those are made out of vellum. They're not exactly books in the sense like pages like this. They're kind of folded sheets, like an accordion, And so vellum lasts very, very well. But papyri doesn't last very well at all. So all the papyri, in other words, all the manuscripts we have from the 2nd and 3rd century are papyri. And others made out of papyrus. And they're all fragments. So if you want an actual, like, nearly entire New Testament, you have to go to the 4th century when they started using vellum. I just gave a talk on that last night, actually. Malcolm was there. Ken was there. Yeah. All right. So are you blown away with more information than you can take in one day? All right. Here's the takeaway lesson. The enemies of Christianity try to create the impression that you can't really take the Bible seriously as history. They'll try to tell you that it's not believable that Moses and the Jews escaped from Egypt. They'll try to tell you that the conquest of the Promised Land is not true. But they have an extreme anti-biblical bias.
Yeah.
And so they can't notice the obvious. Again, I did not give you proof tonight that Egypt conquered, the Jews conquered the Promised Land. What I gave you is information that's completely consistent with the biblical story that makes the biblical story beyond believable. It makes it like almost certainly true, but not proved. Archaeology doesn't prove these kinds of things. It does prove the reality of, say, David and, you know, Omri and Ahab and Jehu and those people. Yeah. Okay, very good. So, a little last word from Malcolm here, and then we'll be let go, in the words of Moses.
All right, a couple announcements for you guys.